content note, today's episode of So Many Books, So Little Time contains a whole bunch of things, including mentions of religion, of prayer, fat phobia or appearance used as a negative descriptor, extreme anxiety, pathological behavior, self-aggrandizement and ego, paranoia, perfectionism, zero self-awareness, a very distorted sense of leadership that is only existing for the purpose of the person advancing rather than the responsibilities and duties towards the people that they are serving. And suicide and mental health are mentioned, and it's pretty rough. Generally, very rough character.
Woo! Hey, folks, Dave here.
And Rue.
And welcome to So Many Books.
So Little Time.
Please join us for another chapter of Catch 22 by Joseph Heller, Colonel Cathcart. Now, for our loyal listeners, we apologize. We weren't around last week. Unfortunately, Rue got hit hard with a viral infection, I believe it was.
Yes, it was not the cough. The cough, it was not, because I had it checked. Yeah, I went in for a check because it was rather rough. I'm still, if you can hear me, I am still a bit funky. I'm still a bit clogged. But at least I'm not coughing constantly and about to pass out every time I do cough. So that's an upside. That's a plus.
Very good. I remember, actually, I won't go into that because that's a pretty graphic story. Anyways.
Yeah.
Yes. Did you get any chance to watch or read anything while you were trying to recover and not die from the coughing?
Yeah, you know, I'm trying to think. I know I've been watching Castle kind of with my mom because you don't have to think.
Your standard procedural with the cast you enjoy, I mean, that's very good.
Yeah. I mean, I notice things that annoy me about it, but then I just kind of go, look, this is not highbrow, you know. No, like it's just fun. You don't have to think too much. There's sneaky bits of humor, which I appreciate. I appreciate sneaky humor.
It's got quips. It's got justice.
Yeah. So it's got propaganda, which we know. You know, it is as most procedural shows are. It is propaganda. We recognize that, but it's kind of.
Well, no, because I've been thinking about, you know, the reason procedurals are so comfortable for so many people, I think, is that idea that something heinous has happened, and at the end of the episode, the person responsible has been rightly punished for it.
Yes, it feels like there's consequences. It feels like there's no imbalance in the system, although we know reality is unfortunately mm-hmm. not necessarily a reflection of that. But it's calming as well, because you know the structure is going to mm-hmm. be a certain way.
Yeah.
It's an expected pattern, I guess.
And I think that was in my early 20s was when I read through the Sherlock Holmes stories. Mm. And, you know, they were made for magazine, for serial, so they were quite short, except for a few, which were longer novel size. And it was great, you know, every night before bed reading just one. It would take maybe 15 to 20 minutes. And, it followed the same beats. You got to follow Sherlock as he displayed his genius and Watson's amazement at it. And it was always very, you know, like what actually happened was always like, wow, that's different. And you got to go to bed just seeing that that justice was done.
Yeah, you kind of appreciate it when it's an unexpected outcome, like an unexpected cause. There's something about that, you know, I didn't think, but it makes sense. It does actually make sense. It does add up. So there's that logical sequence of thought. It's just that sometimes you get caught thinking going down the wrong path. So the red herrings.
There are two, from my understanding, there are two very distinct types of murder mystery or detective story. There's the kind where the reader is able to figure out who did it before the detective does, because the writer leaves clues along the way. And then there's the other kind where the logic train the detective uses to solve it was not able to be followed by any observant reader.
And until it's pointed out.
Yeah, both can be great stories, but I do tend to enjoy the former rather than the latter.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because it feels satisfying to know that, oh, I figured this out. Nice.
It's a puzzle satisfaction. You remember the misplaced tea cozy back in chapter one? Oh, that was actually because they were a person.
Yeah, it's good to I think just having that kind of dopamine rush from puzzling and figuring things out. And it is subtle. It's clever. We like the clever.
Yeah,
the clever,
it's... I think I've heard it, you know, a really good, well-designed murder mystery story is like a game you're playing with your reader.
Yes. And I could see how that would, yeah, it there's something about it that I like my, like the occasional Kathy Reichs or, who is it? Patricia. I haven't read many of her books lately or at all, but it was like just a few. Mysteries are nice to kind of, I mean, we had the thing with Northanger Abbey where you had the little hints dropped here and there of what's going on, and then things that were done to misdirect us and misplace our understanding. But she kept telling us what was going on. It's just
to undercut it almost.
Yeah.
And at that point, like, because, okay, I don't know my history, but it feels like Arthur Conan Doyle was kind of the progenitor of, like, our murder mystery format, but then Agatha Christie really popularized it.
Yes.
In the 20th century. So Northanger Abbey was written well before both those folks.
I think Gothic novels, the point was also to have that mystery and the macabre and like, But I mean, mystery stories and tales have existed since the beginning of storytelling, arguably, because they're left there as a warning almost to, or the unknown, to explain the unknown that, oh, you know, there's things that you need to figure out and to train our minds to think and ask questions.
I'd love, either please do tell us, readers, or I'll look into it. Maybe if someone reminds me, yourself, Rue included, I'll get back to you. But I'd like to find out what is the first recorded plot twist in a story.
I think Shakespeare probably had a few.
Well, see, when you were talking about mystery, my brain was going back through his plays thinking, were any of them really mysteries? Because I don't think they were.
There were some where you had, I mean, you have Hamlet.
He learns out in Act 2 that, no, it's early Act 3. He learns long before the climax of the play that Claudius was responsible for killing his father.
He knows that he was responsible, but he doesn't know, like, the involvement of his mum, for example. He wasn't sure if his mum knew or didn't know.
Well, yes. I mean, the conflict of the rest of the play is also whether or not he believes the apparition.
Yes, yes.
So it's funny you bring up Hamlet, because I listened to an audiobook version of the play just earlier this year, so it is fresh in my mind.
So there's a lot going on. So we've got all these stories. I think Shakespeare had a few. You had Midsummer Night's Dream, which is confusing because Puck causes a lot of chaos.
Yeah, but I don't know.
It's trying to figure out who's actually meant, like, who was the intent? Was this intentional? Was it unintentional? So that's part of the story as well. So it's not the same. It's not the traditional mystery that we're talking about here in terms of, oh, something bad has happened and we need to figure out.
Well, the way I'm thinking of mystery or even plot twist, the idea that at the climax of the story, there is a revelation that changes the way the audience perceived the story. And, even in Midsummer Night's Dream or A Comedy of Errors, which is one of my favorite, because that's that's a play with two sets of identical twins and all the wacky adventures when those get mixed up.
That's pretty funny,
but,
actually.
But, you know, the audience is often told the information early on, and then the joy is in watching the characters bumble about.
But that's I think it's just a style. It's a case of how to approach it depending on the
audience. Well, that's true, because Columbo is beloved, and his mystery stories, you always started the episode showing the person who did it, and then you followed him around as he figured it out for the rest of the show.
So it's just different styles, but I think it's the same concept. I mean, well, I'm sure there's plenty more to it, and
I'm going to look into that.
That's fun.
And if any of you folks listening have any ideas, please tweet at us, email us. You know, I'd love to figure it out.
That'd be a fun one to read as well, if there's a good one out there.
Now, it's been a couple weeks now. Do you remember what happened last time we read Catch 22?
We were somewhere in the timeline. I think we are talking about the different times that he was in Ysterion was hospitalized, and at some stage he was asked to pretend to be a patient who had passed away, because the family didn't get a chance to see their kid before he passed away, and they wanted to give them that option. But Ysterion being Ysterion, he insisted on his actual name.
And the family were so in grief that they just went along with it.
Yeah, it was an interesting kind of situation. And yeah, it was odd. It was odd to say the least. And the idea that that people know that he either is faking, or they know it's not as serious as he's making it out to be, or they consider it not important, but they're just treating Ysterion's condition as though it is, because it's very strange, that whole thing.
I think the entire last chapter was also very early on when he was still a cadet.
Yes, it jumped into the timeline a little back and forth. So we'll see how that was confusing. But there's reasons why he's also a bit frustrated with the where he uses going to the hospital to escape from things, but at the same time there are issues in the hospital itself.
Yep.
So and we knew that there was going to be Colonel Cathcart this chapter.
Yeah. So you've had an extra week to prepare yourself. The thought of reading about Colonel Cathcart made you sick to your stomach.
The generals are terrible, but like the fact that none of them actually give a crap about the people dying.
Well, let's see. Let me run a list of characters I think I don't like at the moment. Because remember, we did discuss about how I came around on Clevenger, but there's Havermeyer. There's Arfi.
He's terrible. Yeah, terrible.
There is Captain Black.
I wonder if there's a ranking list of the worst characters in Catch 22.
Colonel Cathcart is on that list for me as well.
Yeah. Mainly because he keeps committing his people to stuff that they cannot or they should not be doing. Because it's dangerous. So, I mean, it's war. War is dangerous, but he specifically puts them in very awkward positions.
The whole Bologna thing was him.
Yeah. Because he's very ambitious. I think that's why he really rubs me the wrong way. Like, he's ambitious at the cost of his of the people that he's responsible for.
That seems to be a common trait among the officers in this story.
Yes. Yes. And I'm wondering if that's the key experience that Joseph Heller had, and that's why he's
they're more concerned about their own placement and advancement than about winning the war.
Or their fixation, like Lieutenant Scheisskopf, who is all about the formations, and not necessarily that it had a purpose.
Yeah.
Just his pride.
And that wasn't even in a war zone. That was back at the cadet school.
Yeah. So there's a lot of very abusive, avaristic, Power-hungry men.
Yes. So, let us... Colonel Cathcart was a slick, successful, slipshod, unhappy man of 36 who lumbered when he walked and wanted to be a general.
There we go. Avarice.
He was dashing and dejected, poised and chagrined. He was complacent and insecure, daring in the administrative stratagems he employed to bring himself to the attention of his superiors, and craven in his concern that his schemes might all backfire. He was handsome and unattractive, a swashbuckling, beefy, conceited man who was putting on fat and was tormented chronically by prolonged seizures of apprehension. So every now and then he's attacked by his brain going, wait, you're actually doing this thing.
Yeah, I'm like...
No, I recognize that. I think even in fiction, we've seen characters or known people that seem to plow ahead without little regard to what they're doing or why. And well, I guess every now and then those people must have moments of self-reflection. And then maybe they squash those back down like, no, I don't need this.
Yeah, it's just,
It is foreign for someone like me where everything I do, no matter what the intent is, I always have those doubts in my head.
Yeah, well, yeah. It's. I think there's a difference between doubt that makes you reflect and actually think about things versus doubt that prevents you from doing anything to begin with. Yeah, it's pretty hard. They're both very difficult. Very, very difficult.
Colonel Cathcart was conceited because he was a full colonel with a combat command at the age of only 36. And Colonel Cathcart was dejected because although he was already 36, he was only still a full colonel. Colonel Cathcart was impervious to absolutes. He could measure his own progress only in relationship to others. That makes me pity him a bit. And his idea of excellence was to do something at least as well as all the men his own age who were doing the same thing even better. The fact that there were thousands of men his own age and older who had not even attained the rank of major enlivened him with foppish delight in his own remarkable worth. On the other hand, the fact that there were men of his own age and younger who were already generals contaminated him with an agonizing sense of failure and made him gnaw at his fingernails with an unappeasable anxiety that was even more intense than Hungry Joe's. Colonel Cathcart was a very large, pouting, broad-shouldered man with close-cropped, curly dark hair that was graying at the tips and an ornate cigarette holder that he purchased the day before he arrived in Pianosa to take command of his group. He displayed the cigarette holder grandly on every occasion and had learned to manipulate it adroitly. Unwittingly, he had discovered deep within himself a fertile aptitude for smoking with a cigarette holder. As far as he could tell, he was the only cigarette holder in the whole Mediterranean theater of operations, and the thought was both flattering and disquieting. He had no doubts at all that someone as debonair and intellectual as General Peckham approved of his smoking with a cigarette holder, even though the two were in each other's presence rather seldom, which in a way was very lucky, Colonel Cathcart recognized with relief, since General Peckham might not have approved of his cigarette holder at all. When such misgivings assailed Colonel Cathcart, he choked back a sob and wanted to throw the damn thing away, but he was restrained by his unswerving conviction that the cigarette holder never failed to embellish his masculine martial physique with a high gloss of sophisticated heroism that illuminated him to dazzling advantage among all the other full colonels in the American army with whom he was in competition. Although, how could he be sure?
Oh, wow. This guy's got pathological competition.
Colonel Cathcart was indefatigable that way. An industrious, intense, dedicated military tactician who calculated day and night in the service of himself. He was his own sarcophagus, a bold and infallible diplomat who was always berating himself disgustedly for all the chances he had missed and kicking himself regretfully for all the errors he had made. He was tense, irritable, bitter, and smug. He was a valorous opportunist who pounced hoggishly upon every opportunity Colonel Korn discovered for him and trembled in damp despair immediately afterwards at the possible consequences he might suffer. He collected rumors greedily and treasured gossip. He believed all the news he heard and had faith in none.
Like the glue guns.
Hmm?
The glue guns.
Oh.
Yes.
He was on the alert constantly for every signal, shrewdly sensitive to relationships and situations that did not exist.
So he was paranoid.
He was someone in the know who was always striving pathetically to find out what was going on. He was a blustering, intrepid bully who brooded inconsolably over the terrible, ineradicable impressions he knew he kept making on people of prominence who were scarcely aware that he was even alive. Everybody was persecuting him. Colonel Cathcart lived by his wits in an unstable, arithmetical world of black eyes and feathers in his cap, of overwhelming imaginary triumphs and catastrophic imaginary defeats. He oscillated hourly between anguish and exhilaration, multiplying fantastically the grandeur of his victories and exaggerating tragically the seriousness of his defeats. Nobody ever caught him napping. If word reached him that General Dreidel or General Peckham had been seen smiling, frowning, or doing neither, he could not make himself rest until he had found an acceptable interpretation and grumbled mulishly until Colonel Korn persuaded him to relax and take things easy. Lieutenant Colonel Korn was a loyal, indispensable ally who got on Colonel Cathcart's nerves. Colonel Cathcart pledged eternal gratitude to Colonel Korn for the ingenious moves he devised, and was furious with him afterward when he realized they might not work. Colonel Cathcart was greatly indebted to Colonel Korn and did not like him at all. The two were very close. Colonel Cathcart was jealous of Colonel Korn's intelligence and had to remind himself often that Colonel Korn was still only a lieutenant colonel, even though he was almost 10 years older than Colonel Cathcart, and that Colonel Korn had obtained his education at a state university. Colonel Cathcart bewailed the miserable fate that had given him for an invaluable assistant someone as common as Colonel Korn. It was degrading to have to depend so thoroughly on a person who had been educated at a state university. If someone did have to become indispensable to him, Colonel Cathcart lamented, it could just as easily have been someone wealthy and well-groomed, someone from a better family, who was more mature than Colonel Korn, and who did not treat Colonel Cathcart's desire to become a general as frivolously as Colonel Cathcart secretly suspected Colonel Korn secretly did. Colonel Cathcart wanted to be a general so desperately he was willing to try anything, even religion, and he summoned the chaplain to his office late one morning the week after he had raised the number of missions to 60 and pointed abruptly down toward his desk to his copy of the Saturday Evening Post. The colonel wore his khaki shirt collar wide open, exposing a shadow of tough black bristles of beard on his egg-white neck, and had a spongy, hanging upper lip. He was a person who never tanned, and he kept out of the sun as much as possible to avoid burning. The colonel was more than a head taller than the chaplain, and over twice as broad, and his swollen, overbearing authority made the chaplain feel frail and sickly by contrast. "Take a look, chaplain," Colonel Cathcart directed, screwing a cigarette into his holder and seating himself affluently in a swivel chair behind his desk. "Let me know what you think." The chaplain looked down at the open magazine compliantly and saw an editorial spread dealing with an American bomber group in England whose chaplain said prayers in the briefing room before each mission. The chaplain almost wept with happiness when he realized the colonel was not going to holler at him. The two had hardly spoken since the tumultuous evening Colonel Cathcart had thrown him out of the officers' club at General Dreidel's bidding after Chief White Halfoat had punched Colonel Moodis in the nose. The chaplain's initial fear had been that the colonel intended reprimanding him for having gone back into the officers' club without permission the evening before. He had gone there with Yossarian and Dunbar after the two had come unexpectedly to his tent in the clearing in the woods to ask him to join them. Intimidated as he was by Colonel Cathcart, he nevertheless found it easier to brave his displeasure than to decline the thoughtful invitation of his two new friends, whom he had met on one of his hospital visits just a few weeks before, and who had worked so effectively to insulate him against the myriad social vicissitudes involved in his official duty to live on closest terms of familiarity with more than 900 unfamiliar officers and enlisted men who thought him an odd duck.
So this is the chaplain that Yossarian Dunbar met in the hospital
in the first chapter.
And this was at the time where the missions were something like, they'd been raised to 55. Yeah.
Or even earlier,
This is when they were 50 or 55 missions, and that's why Yossarian went back into hospital.
Mm.
And then he's come out, and the same week that he's, I'm trying to think. So before he went and he saw the met Yossarian and Dunbar in the hospital, there was the instance with Chief White half out punching Colonel Mutis on the nose.
Yeah, that seemed to be a signifier of here we are in the timeline. Remember this.
Yeah. So we've got that event, and then you turn and you go, okay, well, they've gone to the hospital and met them, and now it's the missions have been raised to 60 in that same week. He calls the chaplain in ostensibly to do something about the stuff that's in the magazine.
Can we just maybe stop right here? And I want to comment how, I don't think Heller has put that much effort into describing any other character in the book so far than he has with Colonel Cathcart there. And B, the nicest way I think you can say it is this man is completely neurotic.
I would say he's not. Well, as they all are, but I think that his ambition and who he is as a person, that his entire existence and character and everything has to do with comparing yourself to others.
Mm. That's why, remember, the incident said that I'm like, oh, I pity him now. And then it just went more in depth into how deep that was.
He's severely affected. I mean, the fact that Lieutenant Colonel Korn, I mean, we saw how they interacted. When Yossarian was getting told off for flying back and doing the bombing or whatever.
Yeah, Cathcart was beside himself and Korn was calm and like, oh, well, we can do this.
Yes, and we can't do that because that will make us look bad. And constantly reminding Cathcart what would make them look bad. Mm. So he's saving his bacon multiple times.
And we see here that... While Cathcart does appreciate it on some level, he is also disgusted that he's being helped by a man who only went to a state university.
But also that he feels that what was it? It was saying that who considers his desire to become a general very frivolous. So he's kind of like dismissive of like, why? Mm. Why, like, focus on what you're doing. Don't do everything you can in order to earn that elevation of rank, because it's not going to, like, why?
It feels Futurama reference. It feels very Zap Brannigan, where he's willing to just, you know, throw his own men, waves of them at the enemy because it makes him look good. It might make him go up the ranks. It gives him status to keep recommending these offensives, no matter the human cost.
Yeah. But then he also goes, oh, but then... what happens if, like, he does realize that there could be consequences and then he freaks out.
It sounds like he's never at peace.
No.
Which I must say, just like it came out in Clevenger, I don't like Cathcart, but now I feel sympathy for him.
Yeah.
The chaplain glued his eyes to the pages of the magazine. He studied each photograph twice and read the captions intently as he organized his response to the colonel's question into a grammatically complete sentence that he rehearsed and reorganized in his mind a considerable number of times before he was able finally to muster the courage to reply. I think that saying prayers before each mission is a very moral and highly laudatory procedure, sir, he offered timidly and waited. Yeah, said the colonel, but I want to know if you think they'll work here. Yes, sir, answered the chaplain for a few moments. I should think they would. Then I'd like to give it a try. The colonel's ponderous Farinaceous? I've never heard that. Let's see what the dictionary says. Consisting of or containing starch.
So pale.
Oh, wow. That's So
rather than say pale,
his cheeks contain starch. Then I'd like to give it a try. The colonel's ponderous farinaceous cheeks were tinted suddenly with glowing patches of enthusiasm. He rose to his feet and began walking around excitedly. Look how much good they've done for these people in England. Here's a picture of a colonel in the Saturday Evening Post whose chaplain conducts prayers before each mission. If the prayers work for him, they should work for us. Maybe if we say prayers, they'll put my picture in the Saturday Evening Post.
Wow.
The colonel sat down again and smiled distantly in lavish contemplation. The chaplain had no hint of what he was expected to say next. With a pensive expression on his oblong, rather pale face, he allowed his gaze to settle on several of the high bushels filled with red plum tomatoes that stood in rows against each of the walls. He pretended to concentrate on a reply. After a while, he realized that he was staring at rows and rows of bushels of red plum tomatoes, and grew so intrigued by the question of what bushels brimming with red plum tomatoes were doing in a group commander's office that he forgot completely about the discussion of prayer meetings until Colonel Cathcart, in a genial digression, inquired, "Would you like to buy some, Chaplain? They come right off the farm Colonel Corn and I have up in the hills. I can let you have a bushel wholesale." "Oh, no, sir, I don't think so." "That's quite all right," the colonel assured him liberally. "You don't have to. Milo is glad to snap up all we can produce. These were picked only yesterday. Notice how firm and ripe they are, like a young girl's breasts." Oh, the chaplain blushed, and the colonel understood at once that he had made a mistake. He lowered his head in shame, his cumbersome face burning. His fingers felt gross and unwieldy. He hated the chaplain venomously for being a chaplain and making a coarse blunder out of an observation that in any other circumstances he knew would have been considered witty and urbane. He tried miserably to recall some means of extricating them both from their devastating embarrassment. He recalled instead that the chaplain was only a captain, and he straightened at once with a shocked and outraged gasp. His cheeks grew tight with fury at the thought that he had just been duped into humiliation by a man who was almost the same age as he was and still only a captain, and he swung upon the chaplain avengingly with a look of such murderous antagonism that the chaplain began to tremble. The colonel punished him sadistically with a long, glowering, malignant, hateful, silent stare. "We were speaking about something else," he reminded the chaplain cuttingly at last. "We were not speaking about the firm, ripe breasts of beautiful young girls, but about something else entirely. We were speaking about conducting religious services in the briefing room before each mission. Is there any reason why we can't?" "No, sir," the chaplain mumbled. "Then we'll begin with this afternoon's mission." The colonel's hostility softened gradually as he applied himself to details. "Now, I want you to give a lot of thought to the kind of prayers we're going to say. I don't want anything heavy or sad. I'd like you to keep it light and snappy, something that will send the boys out feeling pretty good. Do you know what I mean? I don't want any of this Kingdom of God or Valley of Death stuff. That's all too negative. What are you making such a sour face for?" "I'm sorry, sir," the chaplain stammered. "I happened to be thinking of the 23rd Psalm just as you said that." "How does that one go?" "That's the one you were just referring to, sir. The Lord is my shepherd. That's the one I was just referring to. It's out. What else have you got?" "Save me, O God, for the waters are coming unto..." "No waters," the colonel decided, blowing ruggedly into his cigarette holder after flipping the butt down into his combed brass ashtray. "Why don't we try something musical? How about the harps on the willows?" "That has the rivers of Babylon in it, sir," the chaplain replied. "When we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion." "Zion? Let's forget about that one right now. I'd like to know how that one even got in there." "Haven't you got anything humorous that stays away from waters and valleys and God? I'd like to keep away from the subject of religion altogether if we can."
Where's Corn? Corn could save him right now, but he's not there, obviously. Wow.
"Do you have any non-religious prayers?" "Secular prayers." The chaplain was apologetic. "I'm sorry, sir, but just about all the prayers I know are rather somber in tone and make at least some passing reference to God." "Then let's get some new ones. The men are already doing enough bitching about the missions I sent them on without our rubbing in it with any sermons about God or death or paradise. Why can't we take a more positive approach? Why can't we all pray for something good? Like a tighter bomb pattern, for example. Couldn't we pray for a tighter bomb pattern?" "Well, yes, sir, I suppose so," the chaplain answered hesitantly. "You wouldn't even need me if that's all you wanted to do. You could do that yourself." "I know I could," the colonel responded tartly. "But what do you think you're here for? I could shop for my own food, too. But that's Milo's job, and that's why he's doing it for every group in the area. Your job is to lead us in prayer, and from now on you're going to lead us in a prayer for a tighter bomb pattern before every mission. Is that clear? I think a tighter bomb pattern is something really worth praying for. It will be a feather in all our caps with General Peckham. General Peckham feels it makes a much nicer aerial photograph when the bombs explode close together." "General Peckham, sir?" "That's right, Chaplain," the colonel replied, chuckling paternally at the chaplain's look of puzzlement. "I wouldn't want this to get around, but it looks like General Dreidel is finally on the way out, and that General Peckham is slated to replace him. Frankly, I'm not going to be sorry to see that happen. General Peckham is a very good man, and I think we'll all be much better off under him. On the other hand, it might never take place, and we'd still remain under General Dreidel. Frankly, I wouldn't be sorry to see that happen either, because General Dreidel is another very good man, and I think we'll all be much better off under him, too. I hope you're going to keep all this under your hat, Chaplain. I wouldn't want either one to get the idea I was throwing my support on the side of the other." "Yes, sir. That's good," the colonel exclaimed and stood up jovially. "But all this gossip isn't getting us into the Saturday Evening Post, eh, Chaplain? Let's see what kind of procedure we can evolve. Incidentally, Chaplain, not a word about this beforehand to Colonel Korn. Understand?" "Yes, sir." Colonel Cathcart began tramping back and forth reflectively in the narrow corridors left between his bushels of plum tomatoes and the desk and wooden chairs in the center of the room. "I suppose we'll have to keep you waiting outside until the briefing is over, because all that information is classified. We can slip you in while Major Danby is synchronizing the watches. I don't think there's anything secret about the right time. We'll allocate about a minute and a half for you in the schedule. Will a minute and a half be enough?" "Yes, sir, if it doesn't include the time necessary to excuse the atheists from the room and admit the enlisted men." Colonel Cathcart stopped in his tracks. "What atheists?" he bellowed defensively, his whole manner changing in a flash to one of virtuous and belligerent denial. "There are no atheists in my outfit. Atheism is against the law, isn't it?" "No, sir." "It isn't?" The colonel was surprised. "Then it's un-American, isn't it?" "I'm not sure, sir," answered the chaplain. "Well, I am," the colonel declared. "I'm not going to disrupt our religious service just to accommodate a bunch of lousy atheists. They're getting no special privileges from me. They can stay right where they are and pray with the rest of us. And what's all this about enlisted men? Just how the hell do they get into this act?" The chaplain felt his face flush. "I'm sorry, sir, I just assumed you would want the enlisted men to be present, since they would be going along on the same mission." "Well, I don't. They've got a god and a chaplain of their own, haven't they?" "No, sir. What are you talking about? You mean they pray to the same god we do?" "Yes, sir. And he listens?" "I think so, sir." "Well, I'll be damned," remarked the colonel, and he snorted to himself in quizzical amusement. His spirits drooped suddenly a moment later, and he ran his hand nervously over his short, black, graying curls. "Do you really think it's a good idea to let the enlisted men in?" he asked with concern. "I should think it only proper, sir." "I'd like to keep them out," confided the colonel, and began cracking his knuckles savagely as he wandered back and forth. "Oh, don't get me wrong, Chaplain. It isn't that I think the enlisted men are dirty, common, and inferior. It's just that we don't have enough room. Frankly, though, I'd just as soon the officers and enlisted men didn't fraternize in the briefing room. They see enough of each other during the mission, it seems to me. Some of my very best friends are enlisted men, you understand, but that's about as close as I care to let them come. Honestly now, Chaplain, you wouldn't want your sister to marry an enlisted man, would you?"
Just pointing out. Wow.
So for folks, you may have heard some sighing, but Rue was facepalming during most of that exchange.
Like, oh, wow. Okay, yep.
So what did you want to point out?
Nothing. Just some of my best friends are enlisted men, you understand? Mm-hmm. Oh, it's not that I think they're dirty and common and inferior. We just don't have enough room. So you think they're dirty, common, and inferior. We know.
And we want these prayers to be non-religious, but there's atheists? What? Yeah,
this guy's not, like, what the hell?
I've heard that this general's going to be out and this general's going to be replacing him, which would be great. But on the other hand, this general might stay and that would be great too.
Yeah, but just, guys, wow. Has no awareness, no self-awareness at all. It's bad.
But yes, I'd say a lot of a lack of self-confidence because he's afraid to actually take a stand on anything.
Yeah, but then he makes decisions and then he regrets making those decisions. It's pretty rough. The whole thing's rough.
Yeah. Honestly now, Chaplain, you wouldn't want your sister to marry an enlisted man, would you? My sister is an enlisted man, sir, the chaplain replied. The colonel stopped in his tracks again and eyed the chaplain sharply to make certain he was not being ridiculed. Just what do you mean by that remark, Chaplain? Are you trying to be funny? Oh, no, sir, the chaplain hastened to explain with a look of excruciating discomfort. She's a master sergeant in the Marines. The colonel had never liked the chaplain, and now he loathed and distrusted him. He experienced a keen premonition of danger and wondered if the chaplain, too, were plotting against him. If the chaplain's reticent, unimpressive manner were really just a sinister disguise masking a fiery ambition that way deep down was crafty and unscrupulous. There was something funny about the chaplain, and the colonel soon detected what it was. The chaplain was standing stiffly at attention, for the colonel had forgotten to put him at ease. Let him stay that way, the colonel decided vindictively, just to show him who was boss and to safeguard himself against any loss of dignity that might devolve from his acknowledging the omission. Colonel Cathcart was drawn hypnotically toward the window with a massive, dull stare of moody introspection. The enlisted men were always treacherous, he decided. He looked downward in mournful gloom at the skeet shooting range he had ordered built for the officers on his headquarters staff, and he recalled the mortifying afternoon General Dreidel had tongue-lashed him ruthlessly in front of Colonel Korn and Major Danby and ordered him to throw open the range to all the enlisted men and officers on combat duty. The skeet shooting range had been a real black eye for him, Colonel Cathcart was forced to conclude. He was positive that General Dreidel had never forgotten it, even though he was positive that General Dreidel didn't even remember it, which was really just unjust. Colonel Cathcart lamented, since the idea of a skeet shooting range itself should have been a real feather in his cap, even though it had been such a real black eye. Colonel Cathcart was helpless to assess exactly how much ground he had gained or lost with his goddamn skeet shooting range, and wished that Colonel Korn were in his office right then to evaluate the entire episode for him still one more time and assuage his fears. It was all very perplexing, all very discouraging. Colonel Cathcart took the cigarette holder out of his mouth, stood it on end inside the pocket of his shirt, and began gnawing on the fingernails of both hands grievously. Everybody was against him, and he was sick to his soul that Colonel Korn was not with him in this moment of crisis to help him decide what to do about the prayer meetings.
And yet he's told the chaplain not to tell Colonel Korn. Wow.
He had almost no faith at all in the chaplain, who was still only a captain. Do you think, he asked, that keeping the enlisted men out might interfere with our chances of getting results? The chaplain hesitated, feeling himself on unfamiliar ground again. Yes, sir, he replied finally. I think it's conceivable that such an action could interfere with your chances of having the prayers for a tighter bomb pattern answered. I wasn't even thinking about that, cried the colonel, with his eyes blinking and splashing like puddles. You mean that God might even decide to punish me by giving us a looser bomb pattern? Yes, sir, said the chaplain. It's conceivable he might. The hell with it, then, the colonel asserted in a huff of independence. I'm not going to set these damn prayer meetings up just to make things worse than they are. With a scornful snicker, he settled himself behind his desk, replaced the empty cigarette holder in his mouth, and lapsed into parturient. Let's see what that word means. A woman or female mammal about to give birth in labor. Oh.
So it's a pregnant silence.
Replaced the empty cigarette holder in his mouth and lapsed into parturient silence for a few moments. Now I think about it, he confessed, as much to himself as to the chaplain, having the men pray to God probably wasn't such a hot idea anyway. The editors of the Saturday Evening Post might not have cooperated. The colonel abandoned his project with remorse, for he had conceived it entirely on his own and had hoped to unveil it as a striking demonstration to everyone that he had no real need for Colonel Korn. Once it was gone, he was glad to be rid of it, for he had been troubled from the start by the danger of instituting the plan without first checking it out with Colonel Korn. Oh, boy. Talk about codependency. Well, actually, it's just codependent in one direction.
It's a mess. He's a mess, man.
He heaved an immense sigh of contentment. He had a much higher opinion of himself now that his idea was abandoned, for he had made a very wise decision, he felt, and most important, he had made this wise decision without consulting Colonel Korn. "Will that be all, sir?" asked the chaplain. "Yeah," said Colonel Cathcart, "unless you've got something else to suggest." "No, sir, only..." The colonel lifted his eyes as though affronted and studied the chaplain with aloof distrust. "Only what, chaplain?" "Sir," said the chaplain, "some of the men are very upset since you raised the number of missions to 60. They've asked me to speak to you about it." The colonel was silent. The chaplain's face reddened to the roots of his sandy hair as he waited. The colonel kept him squirming a long time with a fixed, uninterested look devoid of all emotion. "Tell them there's a war going on," he advised finally in a flat voice. "Thank you, sir. I will," the chaplain replied in a flood of gratitude, because the colonel had finally said something. "They were wondering why you couldn't requisition some of the replacement crews that are waiting in Africa to take their places and then let them go home." "That's an administrative matter," the colonel said. "It's none of their business." He pointed languidly toward the wall. "Help yourself to a plum tomato, chaplain. Go ahead. It's on me. Thank you, sir. Sir, don't mention it. How do you like living out there in the woods, chaplain? Is everything hunky-dory?" "Yes, sir." "That's good. You get in touch with us if you need anything." "Yes, sir. Thank you, sir. Sir, thanks for dropping around, chaplain. I've got some work to do now. You'll let me know if you can think of anything for getting our names into the Saturday Evening Post, won't you?" "Yes, sir, I will." The chaplain braced himself with a prodigious effort of the will and plunged ahead brazenly. "I'm particularly concerned about the condition of one of the bombardiers, sir, Yessarian." The colonel glanced up quickly with a start of vague recognition. "Who?" he asked in alarm. "Yessarian, sir." "Yessarian?" "Yes, sir, Yessarian. He's in a very bad way, sir. I'm afraid he won't be able to suffer much longer without doing something desperate." "Is that a fact, chaplain?" "Yes, sir, I'm afraid it is." The colonel thought about it in heavy silence for a few moments. "Tell him to trust in God," he advised finally. "Thank you, sir," said the chaplain. "I will."
And we know that Yessarian doesn't believe in God.
Yeah, and neither does Colonel Cathcart, but it's an easy answer, I guess, to get the chaplain out of there.
So dodgy.
Hmm. Let it all out, Rue.
No, he's just like a terrible person. Like, not... Like, no.
If it's any comfort, he suffers every minute of every day.
That is true. But he's a terrible person who's... Mm-hmm. This is an example of someone who does not take responsibility for his own mental health.
Mm.
In fact, this is advertising for, hi, if this is the kind of approach you have in your life, you might want to consider therapy instead of having other people suffer the consequences for your unmanaged
And of course, approach. I mean, we say that today when therapy still is sadly kind of taboo in society, but back
it's
in the 40s...
It's taboo and also financially inaccessible, but yes.
But back in the 40s, yeah, that there would be no... I mean, the chaplain is basically the closest to therapy they have, right?
Yeah. And he's limited in what he can do.
For some reason, he lives out in the middle of the woods.
Oh, dear.
I'm sure we'll learn more about that when we get a chapter on the chaplain.
Yeah, I think we'll get to know the chaplain a bit more, but it's like he's a terrible person. He's terrible. I'm not processing this very well. I'm like going, oh.
I'll tell you, so there were quite a few odd choices of words that I got kind of tripped up on. I looked up, you know, I probably leave that in the episode. But I'm reading Kurt Vonnegut at the moment, and he was a contemporary of Joseph Heller, same time frame when they were writing. And yeah, same thing. He has a lot of words I have to look up, and it made me think just about the constant evolution of the English language and how certain words fall out of favor. You know, I don't want to say become archaic because I think that's the wrong word, but, you know, they just kind of fall out of use. So, you know, if you're reading an older work, suddenly it's like, oh, what's this word? I've never come across that. And then you actually a good one when you when we talked about that, the Colonel Cathcart taking that pause, and there was a word that meant a woman in labor. And you said, oh, today we would say pregnant pause.
Yeah. And a pregnant pause or a loaded pause is another one.
But just, yeah, that's how the language shifts over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, I mean, we know that also with language that's generally, I mean, particularly with English, words just fall out of favor and we stop using certain words because they just... There's easier ways to express it. We don't connect anymore to the original context in which that word was used. So yeah, it's fun to read books that are older because of that.
Well, yeah, because the thing about, you know, a good writer, they have a skill for, you know, evoking an idea by using very specific language. That's I've talked about it before, but especially when at the start of the chapter, when Heller was just constantly using all these words to describe the kind of man Colonel Cathcart was, and a lot of them were contradictory, it really painted the whole picture because of his very specific use of descriptors. And he's been doing that the whole book, which I've grown such an appreciation for. He has a talent about picking very particular words to explain the situation, you know, what he wants to evoke.
Yeah, it's just constant. Oh my gosh! Like, it's constant Yeah, he is confident, but then he's questioning everything he does, and then he wants to demonstrate he's independent of Korn because he doesn't trust Korn, but at the same time he relies on Korn, and he's proud of himself for not, like, it's just he's a very painful character, and I think he's the one who keeps setting the numbers up.
It said before, he's always been the man behind the numbers.
Yeah, he's the man who keeps increasing the number of missions and ignoring the fact that they need replacements flown in. And not organizing. And I think that's probably because he would have to then admit to the generals that he keeps increasing the number of missions.
Or that his men are worn down for whatever reason.
Yes. Yeah. Or that his men need to be. Yeah. Which would make them also question. I mean, it means that there's a trail of accountability and there's potential consequences for increasing the missions and increasing the missions and dismissing the things that they're going through. The fact that his response to, hey, it's a bit worrisome. This guy's, it's a bit of a worry about Yusarian. He's desperate. And you go, oh, well, just tell him to trust God. It's like, he's trying to avoid any form of accountability, but get all the advantages of being the decision maker.
And it's, I mean, I don't know how protocol works, but my thought would be, even then, the chaplain's basically saying, I'm afraid Yusarian might do something bad to himself. You know, he might kill himself.
Well, he might be. No, he says he's desperate. It could be that, or it could be other things. He could hurt his own crew.
That's true as well, because if you could be a danger to yourself and others.
Exactly.
But let's say, you know, the Assyrian did, go out in a blaze of glory. That's going to look very bad for Colonel Cathcart, especially when it comes out that the chaplain warned him about it beforehand.
Yeah, and so there's that absolute lack of accountability and oh. He just wants to, he's ambitious without regard and without actually necessarily deserving that responsibility. So he wants the ambition without the responsibility.
He's got none of the positive qualities of a leader.
No. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He's there for his own ego, his own aggrandizement. I think that's the word.
Yes, aggrandizement is exactly what it is.
Because his goal, his goal is to be a general. Is it so he can better serve his country? No.
No, it's because he's comparing himself to others and he wants to be better and comparatively based on what he considers better.
Makes me wonder why he joined the army in the first place.
Well, he keeps comparing himself to people who are of a certain rank and station in society. So that
true.
Is...
Yeah, the army is pure hierarchy.
Yes. So he's someone who looks down on State College, for example.
Mm.
So there's things like that that generally are big, giant red flags that something is up with this guy. He's a permanent sense of inferiority, which make war extreme distortion of his self-importance.
Yeah, I believe one of the descriptors was insecurity, and that's a very deep insecurity. Yeah.
Oh, pathologically yeah. insecure, pathologically insecure. And then, I mean, yeah, and again, we've said this before in different podcasts, we can't diagnose him, but there is zero accountability and there's zero, is it me? Am I the baddie? Kind of, there's none of that happening. There's no awareness, no caring about things. It's all about how he looks and how he is perceived and how everyone is out to get him and everyone is whoever's in the way. And even if they're helping him, it makes him look bad because he couldn't have gotten where he got without help.
Yeah, I mean, think of the whole reason behind that chapter. He invites the chaplain to come in because he wants his name in the paper. And he's like, I got an idea that will get my name in the paper, and I'm bringing this man in to help me get what I want. Yes. And the power dynamic shifting throughout that conversation was just bizarre, really.
It was massively weird. And I think this is a term that gets thrown around far too easily and far too much. But if this is straight up narcissism, like it's all about, I mean, there's probably a lot more and I'm not picking it up, but I'm seeing a lot of like, it's all about me, 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 and nothing else. And no, and when someone else responds in a way that you don't like, that doesn't make you feel good about, like, so it doesn't make him feel good about himself or embarrasses him, he gets angry at the person for making him feel embarrassed.
The joke,
which is like, well, in any other setting would have been fine. Had to be a chaplain, right? So then he gets angry at him and furious at him, like to the point where the chaplain's trembling.
And the chaplain was already very apprehensive of meeting him because he, you know, the previous encounter they had when he was thrown out of the officer's lounge.
Mm. So it's yeah, he's terrifyingly bad. Cathcart's scary.
Yeah, it's funny because I now have sympathy for him when I see how messed up he is. But now I think of him in even more negative terms because he's dangerous.
He's dangerous and he has zero sense of responsibility and accountability and even awareness. And it's only the self-awareness that exists is all about how he is perceived and not what he is doing. Like,
the whole thing about the cigarette holder.
Yeah, my gosh. Like, who cares? Who cares if you have a cigarette holder? If someone else cares and they might think you're silly about it, that's their, like, he's completely dependent on how he is perceived. And then at the same time is resentful that's what he's dependent on. It's a mess.
That's, but yes. And that's got to be exhausting. He doesn't rest.
No, I have sympathy towards someone who has this kind of mental space, mm-hmm. even if this is a fictional character, yeah. but in general. But this is where if there's repeatedly something going on where you are being made to question these things, like, oh, you know, I'm worried about the consequences, this perfectionism mm-hmm. as well. That's where, I mean, this is said in the 40s. We've mentioned that the stigma associated with mental health and seeking it. If in any way your thoughts and your feelings are disruptive to you making decisions in your life, that's a perfectly reasonable time to seek counseling. And it's not necessarily to be diagnosed with anything. It can simply be to talk to someone who make sure that you mesh with them first, but mesh with them and then express yourself and get things out and reflect on the thoughts and the feelings and see what's going on with how you process the world.
Mm.
and whether something is distorting that potentially, and whether that needs to be dissected or whether it just has to be kind of develop some methods to bridge over it. So whatever it is, but when someone has these disruptive behaviors and impacts on others, and he is distressed. He's in a constant state of distress.
Yeah.
But he doesn't think to seek. I mean, that's part in this character's case. It's part of his pathology is that he resents the fact that he would need to seek help.
Mm-hmm.
And he would resent the person that advised it to him, but also he would resent the fact that he had to go to that person.
Yeah.
The professional and seek help. So it's, and resent the professional. So it's a real mess. But yes. So on that note, if you can, therapy can be helpful. Good therapy can be very helpful. Good therapy can be very helpful.
No, it's one of those things where you've got to find the right person.
Yes, you've got to find the right person and be willing. Like, if you go to therapy and you're not willing to, I guess, learn about boundaries, learn to set boundaries, communicate them, but also to allow a space where you go through things that are difficult and discomforting. It will be uncomfortable moments. But I mean, for me, a good therapist is someone who allows you to go through uncomfortable things in a space that is safe and will bring you out of that uncomfortable moment enough for you to have, you know, be facing the discomfort and actually experiencing growth.
And for me, at least, a green flag, something you should look for, is ask whether your therapist gets therapy themselves.
Yes, yes. And understands the value of therapy and the role that they can play. Yeah, yeah. So it's.
Although then I've heard a joke about that where you keep going up the chain until you get to the final therapist and then you let them handle you.
You always have to find the person that works for your particular...
I've been trying recently and I have found someone who's able to help me with the problem I have. But unfortunately, right now, I am not in a financial situation I cannot afford this person. So I got to wait till circumstances change.
That's a whole conversation as well that we need to, it's not good enough to say, oh, I'll just seek therapy. It's like, well, like these things require financial and system structures. Like it's not, there's waiting lists and there's costs and it's not that accessible. So we need to make therapy more accessible and more adapted to the patient's actual, well, the person's actual needs.
And accepted.
And accepted. Well, yeah, stigma is part of it, but also understanding the role.
Mm.
But yes, yes.
Well, I hope you all enjoyed yourself. I hope you're feeling okay, Rue. I know you're still recovering. Are you?
I'm okay. You got through? I've got to just get myself ready for the rest of the day. But yes.
Yes. We have a dinner tonight. Yes, friend is having her birthday, so that should be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And hopefully we'll see you next week. The music at the top of the podcast is Soap Runs by Rupert Gregson-Williams and Harry Gregson-Williams. It's from the 2019 adaptation of Catch-22. The music at the end of the podcast is I'm the Slime by Frank Zappa. You can find me over on Twitter at Dave_the_turnip.
And you can find me at Rue McMoo, that's R-O-O-M-C-M-O-O, on Twitter as well. And you can find our podcast at SMBSLT Podcast. That's on Twitter as well as Facebook. And if you add @gmail.com, you get our email address. Yes.
Please contact us if you have any thoughts as to what the earliest story with a plot twist is.
I really want to know.
I wonder if it's Beowulf.
It's always Beowulf.
But until next time, enjoy your reading, stay safe, and we'll see you next week, folks.
Happy reading.